Well, as we come to verse 12, verses 12 and 18 are a record of the genealogy of Ishmael. Ishmael, of course, was the son of Abraham and Hagar. You remember this was Abraham's attempt to help God fulfill his promise. And Ishmael was blessed because he was a descendant of Abraham, but you remember God said his covenant was with Isaac. And so this is pretty much where the story of Ishmael comes to an end, because he is not relevant to the continuation of the story, because of course the story is ultimately about those who are in the messianic line. So again, verses 12 through 18 record for us a bit about Ishmael, his genealogy, and then about his death as well. So picking up in verse 19, we come back now to Isaac. Isaac, who is the heir of the promise. So this is the genealogy of Isaac, Abraham's son. Abraham begot Isaac. Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebekah as wife, the daughter of Bethuel, the Syrian of Paddan Aram, the sister of Laban, the Syrian. Now Isaac pleaded with the Lord for his wife because she was barren. And the Lord granted his plea, and Rebekah, his wife, conceived. Now, pausing just for a moment, remember the promise that God had given to Abraham, that his descendants would be as numerous as the sand on the seashore and the stars in the heavens. And Abraham, of course, has only Isaac. And then Isaac, now after 20 years of marriage with Rebekah, Rebekah is unable to conceive. And, you know, the thing that I find interesting here is that even though God had given that promise, and in one sense, it seems that they could have just sort of, you know, laid back and just said, well, you know, the Lord gave the promise and one of these days he's going to fulfill it. We'll just wait for that to happen. They didn't do that. They sought the Lord. Isaac sought the Lord. And I think in that there's just, you know, something for us as well. Just because God has given us certain promises and given us a real confidence that, you know, certain things are going to take place, it doesn't mean that we just sort of lay back and do nothing. We need to be proactive, and we need to continue to persevere in prayer to bring those things to fruition. And so we see that with Isaac. He's pleading with the Lord for Rebekah, and so she conceives. But the children struggled together within her, and she said, if all is well, why am I like this? So she went to inquire of the Lord, and the Lord said to her, two nations are in your womb. Two people shall be separated from your body. One people shall be stronger than the other, and the older shall serve the younger. So Rebekah is pregnant with twins, and obviously a difficult pregnancy. And so the Lord reveals to her something about the nature of these two children within her womb. So when her days were fulfilled for her to give birth, indeed there were twins in her womb. And the first came out red, He was like a hairy garment all over. So they called his name the hairy one. Esau, meaning the hairy one. Afterward, his brother came out, and his hand took hold of Esau's heel, so his name was called Jacob, which means heel catcher. Isaac was 60 years old when she bore them. So these two sons now. Now, remember, this is an entirely different situation than was the situation with Abraham. Abraham had the two sons, but only one of them was through Sarah, and only one of them was the promised seed. But now here with Isaac, he has two sons by Rebekah. And yet only one of them will receive that blessing, that messianic blessing. So the boys grew, and Esau was a skillful hunter, a man of the field, but Jacob was a mild man dwelling in tents. And Isaac loved Esau because he ate of his game, but Rebekah loved Jacob. Now, this is a strange translation here regarding Jacob, that he was a mild man. It gives the wrong impression, I think. And sometimes there's even been a contrast between, Esau and Jacob, as though one were sort of a man's man and the other was, you know, a bit of a mama's boy. But that's really not at all what the word implies, and it is really an unfortunate translation, this word mild or plain, because the word really means more literally perfect or mature. It's the exact same word that we find in Job chapter 1 verse 8, where God is speaking of Job as being a perfect man, the same Hebrew word. And so the picture here, the contrast really between Esau and Jacob is really the contrast between a mature, godly, spiritual-minded man, that's Jacob, and an immature, godless, irresponsible type of a person. That's the contrast between these two men. Esau is essentially a man who has no regard for the things of the Spirit. No regard. He's godless in that sense. He just simply is not interested in spiritual things. He's interested in the world. He's interested in the outdoors. He's interested in being out in the fields and hunting. He has no sense of responsibility. He's not at all taking life seriously. Where Jacob, on the other hand, he's a mature man in the sense that he understands that the spiritual element is the most important element of life. And he's a responsible man. He's dwelling in tents. He's taking care of business. He's taking care of family. He's taking care of his father's flocks and those things, while Esau is out just, you know, having a good time. He's too busy having fun to get himself involved in the more important matters of the family and so forth. So this is the distinction that's really being drawn here. But notice verse 28, and Isaac loved Esau because he ate of his game, but Rebekah loved Jacob. Now, once again, we're going to see, sadly, with Isaac, we're going to see that human side really show itself. Just as we saw with Abraham, you remember as we looked at his life, you know, many wonderful aspects of Abraham's character and his faith and his commitment. But then we would see occasionally those weak areas. And so with Isaac as well. And Isaac, even though he's God's man, even though he's the one through whom the promise is going to be carried on, he still has that element of the flesh. And he's drawn more to Esau, not because Esau was spiritual, but really just quite the opposite. He was drawn to the fact that Esau was a hunter, that Esau could provide him with this excellent food as he would go out hunting. And so with Isaac, we see that there was a side of him where he wasn't as spiritual as he probably should have been. But Rebekah loved Jacob. Rebekah gets this promise from God. The older shall serve the younger. And so she's putting her hopes in the promises. She's putting her hopes in the things of the Spirit. And she senses with Jacob that he is a spiritually minded man. Now, Jacob cooked a stew. And Esau came in from the field and was weary. And Esau said to Jacob, "Please feed me with that same red stew, for I am weary." It's interesting. I was looking in a couple of my Hebrew sources, and what Esau actually said literally was, "Let me gulp down all of that stew that you've made." You know, so we're talking about a guy who's just, you know, he's just really given over to his fleshly appetites. He's been out hunting all day and he's been out in the field, and now he comes in and he just says, "Let me gulp the whole thing down." That's literally what he said. So that's therefore his name is called Edom. Edom means red. He's asking for that red stew. But Jacob said, "Sell me your birthright as of this day." And Esau said, "Look, I'm about to die, so what is this birthright to me?" Then Jacob said, "Swear to me as of this day." So he swore to him and sold his birthright to Jacob. And Jacob gave Esau bread and stew of lentils. Then he ate and drank, arose and went his way. Thus Esau despised his birthright. Now, I don't think there's any doubt whatsoever based upon this that Rebekah had communicated at least to Jacob, and no doubt to Isaac as well, and perhaps even to Esau. Rebekah had communicated that God had spoken to her. The older, Esau, would serve the younger, Jacob. Now, of course, the one with the birthright is the one who's going to inherit the authority over the family. So what Jacob is doing, and now this is where we see Jacob's problem. He's a spiritual man. He's mindful of the things of the Spirit, where Esau disregards them. But Jacob's problem is he's impatient. And somewhat like Abraham with Hagar, he feels that he's got to help God out. He's got to manipulate the situation in order to bring to pass what God had declared, that the older would serve the younger. That's really what he's after when he asks for the birthright. But you know, it's interesting that the final word is not that Jacob supplanted Esau, But the final word is that Esau despised his birthright. You see, God doesn't really even condemn Jacob for this, although we would have to say in looking at the bigger picture, it wasn't the right way to go about it. It was one of those things where you have a situation where Jacob's heart is right, in as much as he's spiritual and he wants the spiritual blessing, but his method of going about it, that's where he's making his mistake. Where Esau, on the other hand, he couldn't care less about the birthright. He has no interest whatsoever. When we come to the New Testament and to the epistle to the Hebrews, Esau is referred to as a profane person. Now, when we think of the word profane, we usually think of somebody who's vulgar or, extremely wicked or something like that. But the word in the Bible, profane, doesn't really mean that. The word profane means simply that he was common or he was disinterested in spiritual blessing. So this is the kind of person that Esau really was. He was a person who wasn't a bad person in the sense of being an extremely wicked person. He was just a person who didn't really have any time or interest in the things of the Spirit. You know, there are a lot of people in the world like that today. They're not necessarily overtly wicked. As a matter of fact, they might even look down upon extremely wicked people. They might condemn certain behaviors and lifestyles. But they just don't see any need for God or anything spiritual in their lives. They're common. They're profane. Esau despised his birthright. It didn't mean anything to him. So now this seems to have happened when these boys were relatively young, probably in their teenage years. But we're going to see how this whole thing develops as we go on further in the story, and we'll pick that up when we come to chapter 27. But now we go back to Isaac. So there was a famine in the land beside the first famine that was in the days of Abraham. And Isaac went to Abimelech, king of the Philistines, in Gerar. Now, it was about 100 years earlier that Abraham went to Abimelech in the same area. And it seems, and most scholars agree, that Abimelech was not a personal name, but a title. Probably the title of the chief over the Philistines at that time. So this would not be the same person, but probably the son of the Abimelech that Abraham dealt with. And so we read, then the Lord appeared to him. Isaac is going in the direction of the south. The Lord appeared to him and said, do not go down to Egypt. Live in the land of which I shall tell you. Dwell in this land, and I will be with you and bless you. For to you and your descendants I give all these lands, and I will perform the oath which I swore to Abraham, your father. And I will make your descendants multiply as the stars of heaven. I will give to your descendants all these lands, and in your seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed, because Abraham obeyed my voice and kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws. So Isaac dwelt in Gerar. So here the Lord reiterates to Isaac the promise that he had made to Abraham. So Isaac is now officially the recipient of the promise, and it's through Isaac that the promise is going to be carried on. And the men of the place asked about his wife. And he said, she is my sister. For he was afraid to say, she is my wife, because he thought, lest the men of the place kill me for Rebekah, because she is beautiful to behold. Now, does this sound familiar to you? I mean, this is absolutely astounding, really, because we see Isaac repeating the exact same mistake that Abraham had made. But Abraham had done this before Isaac was ever born. But no doubt it was one of those things that was probably talked about around the house. Probably Sarah would remind Abraham on occasion. And Isaac, of course, would have overheard that. And so here he's doing a similar thing. Now with Abraham, remember, Abraham had a little bit of a basis for saying that because Sarah was actually his half-sister. But now with Isaac, he has no basis for that whatsoever. He has no other relationship to Rebekah than the fact that she is his wife. But he's afraid, so he says, she is my sister. Now it came to pass when he had been there a long time that Abimelech, king of the Philistines, looked through a window and saw, and there was Isaac showing endearment to Rebekah, his wife. Then Abimelech called Isaac and said, quite obviously, she is your wife. So how could you say she is my sister? Isaac said to him, because I said, lest I die on account of her. And Abimelech said, what is this you have done to us? One of the people might soon have lain with your wife, and you would have brought guilt on us. So Abimelech charged all his people, saying, he who touches this man or his wife shall surely be put to death. Now, remember back 100 years ago when this similar incident occurred, God had actually cursed the people because of Sarah being there. So evidently this is in the mind of Abimelech. He remembers the story. He evidently heard the story as well himself. So he's saying, what are you doing to us? You could have brought a judgment upon us. So Isaac then, there in that region, he sowed in that land and reaped in the same year 100-fold, and the Lord blessed him. The man began to prosper and continued prospering until he became very prosperous. For he had possessions of flocks and possessions of herds and a great number of servants, so the Philistines envied him. Now the Philistines had stopped up all the wells which his father's servants had dug in the days of Abraham his father, and they had filled them with earth. And Abimelech said to Isaac, go away from us, for you are much mightier than we. Then Isaac departed from there and pitched his tent in the valley of Gerar and dwelt there. Now, this, the time frame for all of this, we know that Isaac was married when he was 40. He had Esau and Jacob when he was 60. And now we're at the end of the story here, we're going to be told about Esau marrying at the age of 40. So a lot of years are transpiring here. And remember, Isaac is he's the heir. He's got the promises of God. He's the son of Abraham. He's that promised seed. He's the one who submitted himself to his father there on Mount Moriah. He's the one who cried out to God for Rebekah to conceive. But here's my point. He's God's man. He's in God's will. He's moving toward God's fulfilling of his purposes in his life. But he's experiencing difficulty. He's experiencing conflict. He's experiencing trouble. And what that tells us is simply this. Jesus said it, in the world you will have tribulation. You know, sometimes we think wrongly, but we do think this quite often. We think, you know, if I'm right with the Lord and if I'm right in the center of God's plan, everything is going to be just rosy. Everything's going to be great. I'm not going to have any problems. And then when I run into difficulty, when I find myself facing trouble or distress, I immediately begin to question whether or not I'm really where God wants me to be. But over and over again, we find this kind of a thing all throughout the scripture. Sometimes things are the most difficult when you're right smack in the middle of God's will. Boy, I think of David, and what an example of that there. You know, here's David, and he's God's man. He's anointed by Samuel to be the king over Israel. And he has this great victory. You know the story as he goes out and slays Goliath. And he becomes this great champion. He becomes this great leader. But before too long, you know, Saul becomes envious of David. And Saul turns against David. And many in the kingdom turn against David. And then there's this long, drawn-out period of time where David, God's man, God's anointed, the man upon whom all of the promises of God are resting, finds himself in one difficult situation after another. And it seems like it's never going to end. But of course, we know that God ultimately brings David through. But we have to realize that being in the center of God's will doesn't necessarily mean that everything is going to go real smoothly. It doesn't mean that we won't have trouble. It doesn't mean that we won't have difficulty. We will. For a number of reasons. One of the reasons, of course, is because there's a devil. And the devil is opposing God's will. So when you're in God's will and you're moving deeper into the fulfillment of God's purpose for your life, you can bet your life that the enemy is not going to sit back idly and just allow that to happen. He is going to do what he can to try to thwart that plan. He's going to come against you with everything and try to stop you from advancing and progressing into the will of God. And then, of course, there's just the difficulty and the struggles of life itself. So all of this to say, at some point we need to get a hold of this understanding. It'll help us tremendously. We won't go through all of those mental gymnastics so often and those condemning kinds of experiences because we think, oh no, I must have blown it, or God must be upset with me, or he must be angry at me, or he must have forsaken me because look at what's happening in my life. No, that's not the case, because as we pointed out before, these things that come our way, whether they come through the agency of the devil or they come just as a result of living in a fallen world, these are the things that God uses to refine us and to purify us and to develop character in us and to actually further prepare us for the work that he has for us, both now, presently, and on into eternity. You see that with David. God is chiseling away at this man to prepare him to lead the nation as he would lead it. You think of another man who went through similar kind of suffering, Joseph. This happy-go-lucky young man who didn't have really a care in the world. His brothers were upset at him quite a bit, but his dad loved him and had set his affection upon him. And we'll get to his story in a little while. But just to refresh your memory, everything's great until one day he goes out to greet his brothers, and they, because of their envy, they throw him into a pit. And then you know the story. He ends up sold into slavery. He ends up eventually in prison. And for 13 long years, he's in this extremely difficult situation where it would have seemed from a human standpoint that God had forsaken him almost. But yet it was in that season that God was actually developing the character of Joseph so that at the appointed time, Joseph could come forth and stand before Pharaoh and be given authority over all the land of Egypt. But you see, it was that season of suffering and difficulty that developed the character in him that enabled him then to lead the nation wisely as he would do. So, Joseph went through it. Abraham had those long, long years of waiting and those difficulties. David went through it. And here we see Isaac. He's being driven out because of envy on the part of the Philistines. And so he has to pack up everything and he has to now seek out a new location. This is a hardship. This is a difficulty. But he's God's man and he's in the will of God. And so Isaac departed. He pitched his tent in the valley of Gerar. And Isaac dug again the wells of water, which they had dug in the days of Abraham his father. For the Philistines had stopped them up after the death of Abraham. What a cruel thing to do, stopping up a well. He called them by the names which his father had called them, the wells. Also, Isaac's servants dug in the valley and found a well of running water there. So they found running water. Excited. All right, this is the place. We can settle down here. But the herdsmen of Gerar quarreled with Isaac's herdsmen, saying, "The water is ours." So he called the name of the well Esek, because they quarreled with him. Esek means quarreled. Then they dug another well, and they quarreled over that one also. So he called its name Sitna. Sitna means enmity. And he moved from there and dug another well, and they did not quarrel over it. And he called its name Rehoboth, because he said, "For now the Lord has made room for us, and we shall be fruitful in the land." Then he went up from there to Beersheba. So, again, we're reading this. It's just historical information to us. But, you know, living it would have been a very challenging thing. Digging these wells, finding the water, being excited about potentially being able to settle, but then because of the strife and the contention, having to move on, and then having to move on again, but then finally coming to that place that he refers to as Rehoboth. I do think that similar kinds of things happen with us. And in a sense, it's all as we move toward that Rehoboth, as we move toward that spacious area or that place really that God has prepared for us. You know, God has a calling on our lives. And of course, one of the things that we must do is we must seek out the will of God. And we must seek to know just what it is that the Lord has for us and where it is that he would have us to labor. And sometimes in our attempt to discover that, we can find ourselves in quarrelsome kinds of situations. Sometimes we can find ourselves in places of contention. But there is, I believe, there is that Rehoboth. We have to keep moving, just like Isaac did. If you're at a place, you're wanting to serve the Lord, and yet you're at a place where you just feel like, you know, there's nothing here but strife, then perhaps you need to move in a different direction. You might move in a different direction. You might find yourself in a place where there's still contention, or there's just something about it that doesn't really, you know, it doesn't really settle. But you know, as you seek to know the will of God and as you follow after His will, there will come a place, I believe, for each one of us who are sincerely pursuing that, there will come a place where it will be for us like it was for Isaac. It will be a Rehoboth. It will be a place where we will just sit back and say, yes, this is the place. Now the Lord has made room for us and we're going to bear fruit in this place. But what happens sometimes is that people get discouraged in the process and decide to give up. Oh, I tried it over there and it didn't work out and there was all kinds of strife. And then I went over and did this and boy, that didn't come together either. And I'm just tired of this. And so I'm going to go do something else. You know, it just really comes down to having a deep conviction about what God has called you to do. I was talking to a man recently who's pastoring a church, or at least attempting to. And he's got all kinds of strife, all kinds of contention. A few people just don't want him to be there. And so, you know, he was basically asking for my advice. What do you think I should do? I said, well, this is the first thing. You got to start with this. What does God want you to do? What do you believe? What's your conviction? Do you have a deep conviction from the Lord that you're supposed to do this thing? I said, if you don't have that, then my advice is you probably ought to pack up and head out. But if you do have that, then don't let anybody move you from where you're at. So, you know, we need to be seeking the Lord to really discover from Him what it is that He's called us to do. And if He's called us to something, then we got to stick it out regardless of how difficult it might be, knowing that there will come a day when God will make room. It'll be sorted out. It'll be spacious and we can bear fruit there. But if we don't have the absolute confidence that God's called us to it, then perhaps all of that strife and all of that contention, perhaps that's an indicator that we need to move somewhere down the road. Maybe there's another place that God has for you. But again, I believe that God has a Rehoboth for each one of us. He has a place where you are going to bear fruit. He has a place where your gifts are uniquely designed for that particular task, or for ministry to those people. Keep on seeking that Rehoboth. Keep on looking for that place where the Lord will settle you and bring that blessing. It'll come. So from there he went to Beersheba. And the Lord appeared to him the same night and said, I am the God of your father, Abraham. Do not fear, for I am with you. I will bless you and multiply your descendants for my servant Abraham's sake. So Isaac built an altar there and called on the name of the Lord, and he pitched his tent there, and there Isaac's servants dug a well. So it's interesting to me too, that when he comes to that place where he senses, okay, this is the place, there's room here, we can spread out, we can bear fruit, the Lord comes with the confirmation that this is indeed that place of blessing for him. And that's what will happen. God will come and he will give us that confirmation. He'll give us that confirmation, I think, in a number of ways. He'll give us that confirmation in the sense that we'll have that peace that just comes upon us. He'll give us confirmation in the sense that others will bear witness. He'll give us confirmation in the area of fruit will be born from it. So God gives Isaac that confirmation, and Isaac there builds an altar to the Lord. Then Abimelech came to him from Gerar with Ahuzath, one of his friends, and Phicol, the commander of his army. And Isaac said to them, "Why have you come to me, since you hate me and have sent me away from you?" But they said, "We have certainly seen that the Lord is with you." So we said, "Let there now be an oath between us, between you and us, and let us make a covenant with you that you will do us no harm, since we have not touched you and since we have done nothing to you but good and have sent you away in peace. You are now the blessed of the Lord." So he made them a feast, and they ate and they drank. Then they arose early in the morning and swore an oath with one another, and Isaac sent them away, and they departed from him in peace. And it came to pass the same day that Isaac's servant came and told him about the well which they had dug, and said to him, "We have found water." So he called it Sheba. Therefore the name of the city is Beersheba to this day. So Beersheba means the well of the oath. The well of the oath. And we see one additional thing here. Those who were formerly striving with Isaac, notice they come back around and they want peace. And you know, again, that's what happens when we, as we keep seeking, and this is the thing that I want to just emphasize in closing tonight. We have to keep seeking. I've talked to so many people that are frustrated because they feel like they can't discover the will of God. They can't get into the will of God. They don't know what God's will is. But don't be frustrated and don't give up. But do rather what Jesus said to do. He said, keep on asking, keep on seeking, keep on knocking. And at some point, he promised, those who keep on asking will receive. Those who keep on seeking will find. And those who keep on knocking, to them the door will be open. You know, for some reason, and this is something I don't understand, but it seems to be a reality. God, a lot of times, pushes us to a limit. God, a lot of times, for whatever reason, you know, he wants to see us really want something. And express that desire by, you know, "Lord, I'm not going to settle. I'm not going to settle for anything less." What he's looking to see really is passion. Do we really care? Do we really want that thing? And I think of, you know, so many that they've got a deep, intense, passionate thing, but it doesn't last. It's short-lived. And they never receive the promise. They never really enter into the blessing. But why is that? Because they didn't keep seeking. You see, we've got to keep seeking out the will of God, knowing for sure that if we keep on seeking, if you haven't discovered it yet, then don't stop. Keep seeking. But God is looking for fervency. He's looking for intensity. He's looking for for passion. He's looking for people that say, you know, Lord, I want you to work in my life. And I'm not going to take no for an answer. What is it through the prophet Isaiah, I think it was. Isaiah says, give him no rest till he makes Jerusalem a blessing in the earth. Keep on crying out to God. I think of that story where it was, I can't remember which king it was. But it's at the, toward the end of Elisha's life. And one of the kings comes to him and Elisha takes him over to the window and he opens the window and he says, get out your bow and you're going to shoot an arrow out the window. It's the arrow of the Lord's deliverance. But he says to him, take your arrows and strike the ground. And the king takes his arrows and he sort of taps the ground. And Elisha says, oh, what is the matter with you? God was ready to deliver your enemies into your hand. He was going to give you victory, but now you're only going to smite the Syrians twice. You're not going to have a full victory. And why? Because he had no passion. He had no heart. The prophet said, you should have struck the ground several times. And you know, sometimes I think that's kind of where we're at. Oh yeah, it'd be nice if God did something, and oh, I'd like him to do something, but do we really want it? Are we really crying out to the Lord? I mean, you know, we look at our world and we're, I think, you know, pretty much aware that things are going from bad to worse, and we talk about it a lot, and we say, oh, you know, we need a work of God's Spirit. We need a revival. We need a great move of the Spirit of God. We talk about it and we write books about it and all of that. But, you know, do we ever really get down and say, Lord, we're not going to rest until this comes? Keep on asking. Keep on seeking. Keep on knocking. There is that Rehoboth. There is that place, that spacious area where God will bless and where fruit will come. You must keep pursuing it. Keep seeking it out. Don't stop short. The Lord has so much that he wants to do in each one of our lives. And of course, it varies from person to person exactly how that is going to work itself out and what it's going to look like specifically. But there's something there for you. There's something there for you in your family. There's something there for you in your business. There's something there for you just in the community in general. There's something there for you in the church. There's something there in all of our lives that God has for us. And our responsibility is to seek that out. And sometimes, as we see here with Isaac, sometimes the Lord is going to allow a difficulty to come along. Sometimes he's going to allow some trouble to arise. Sometimes he's going to allow a situation where somebody says, you know, you need to go. Maybe your boss says, you need to go. And you think this is the worst day of your life, when the fact of the matter is, this could be the best day of your life. Because you never would have gone out and gotten into the will of God. But now you're being thrust out. But go out with expectation. God's got something better for me. God's got something fresh. God's got something new. God's got something exciting. God has a Rehoboth, a spacious, fruitful place for you. And so, verse 34, closing the chapter. When Esau was 40 years old, he took his wives, Judith, the daughter of Beeri the Hittite, and Basemath, the daughter of Elon the Hittite, and they were a grief of mind to Isaac and Rebekah. So back to Esau, the man who has no vision beyond his own personal enjoyment, has no real concern for the things of the Spirit, and now once again showing that by the choices that he makes, disregarding the covenant, disregarding all of those things that his parents held dear, and taking as wives these Hittite women. So, as we move on in the story, of course, Esau is going to become less and less relevant, with the exception of his ongoing issues with Jacob. But from this point forward, the book of Genesis is going to focus predominantly upon Jacob. And of course, Jacob will become Israel. And from him, the tribes of Israel will come. So we'll continue to follow his life as we pick things up next week.